great pleasure to come and sit in the Crick room under the benevolent eye of the portrait of Crick and hear a talk about Francis Crick, arguably the greatest scientist of the age, by Matt Ridley, who in my opinion is one of the great science writers of the age. As you all know, all great scientists are from Britain and all great scientific writers are from Britain. Jim Watson was American, but he did his best work in Britain. Now, Matt Ridley is the author of a number of books called The Red Queen, a rather nice book called Nature versus Nurture.
Via Nurture.
I beg your pardon?
Nature via Nurture. That's the whole point.
What's he know?
That's not a bad story.
Nature versus Nurture. What? I have decisively disproved the Nurture theory of IQ. Francis Crick once left his hat at my house, so I wore it for 3 weeks to see if his brains would rub off. Results were negative. Now, I should explain, that's giving two talks today. He's giving a talk at the Salt this afternoon on Francis Crick at work, and a talk here now on Francis Crick at play. Does this tell us how people see the Salt versus this department? Which one worry about? Now, it tells us all about Crick. I shall perversely take the iconoclastic view and point out that a number of fans of Linus Pauling said, if Crick hadn't discovered it, somebody else would have. Again, there are fans of Rosalind Franklin, who having read The Double Helix, say this book should be called How We Stole Our Way to a Nobel Prize. Matt also put this subversive idea in context. Now, Matt Ridley very kindly had me to stay with him in England once. His wife is the wonderful Anya Hurlburt, who's the chair of psychology at Newcastle, and she said, come and stay at our little place for the weekend. So I went over. They put me in a four-poster bed in the guest room. The guest room was slightly larger than my house. I thought, God, poor old Matt, how can he afford the heating bill for this place? But after breakfast, Matt said, would you like to see my coal mine? I said, yes, all right. Where is it? At the bottom of the garden. I said, okay, we'll walk down. He said, we can't walk, it's too far. His garden is 8,000 acres. So we drove down, left hand, this bloody goat. And I said, didn't know he had this hill. It's not a hill, he said, this is the tailings from my coal mine, 2 million tons of rock. We got to the top of the hill, there was this cliff, looked like a giant slice of bacon, but the red bits were black. He said, that's my coal mine. I said, how much coal have you got here? He said, a million tons, I think, but we're not quite sure. So I've stopped worrying about his paying heating bills. If I'm not too worried about Matt Ridley's entire future, I give you Matt Ridley.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So I should just point out, it's not my coal, it belongs to the Queen.
Oh, the Queen.
But I can sort of charge people to get at it, and that's how I make my living. Thank you very much. It's a tremendous honour to be here in a room named after Francis Crick to talk about Francis Crick. I'm seriously intimidated by his eyes because they're staring straight at me, and I just know he's going to ask a very difficult question about halfway through, but I will try and ignore it. The book came out this week. It's called Francis Crick, The Discoverer of the Genetic Code. You have to have a subtitle, and I'm trying to draw attention in the book particularly to the fact that he's not just the double helix man, he's also the genetic code man to a large extent, and I'll talk about that. It's not a full biography. Robert Olby's doing a huge biography of Francis Crick, which will come out next year. It's more of a biographical portrait. It's in this series called Eminent Lives, which have to be short. The whole point of them is that they're sort of snapshots. So although I cover all of his life, I do some bits very briefly, like the last the Californian years, the last 30 years of his life is covered very briefly. And I make the case in it that Francis Crick is one of the great scientists of all time, not just up there with the good ones, but really in the sort of company of people like Darwin and Galileo and Einstein. Why so? Well, because of the momentous nature of the discoveries that he was associated with. Now, I do say associated with because he did all his work in collaboration with others. But the revolution in molecular biology that completely explained the two features of life that are so characteristic of it, one, that it copies itself, and two, that it can build eddies in the stream of entropy, if you like, that it can build bodies that capture energy for growth and movement, both boil down to the genetic code. And between them, these discoveries were completely surprising, universal, transcendent, and as big an event in the history of science, in my view, as something like natural selection. So later at the Salk, I'm going to talk in more detail about particularly the work after the double helix. I'll summarise it briefly here. But what I want to do here is tell you something about who Francis Crick was and where he came from and what his background was before the double helix, and what made him tick, what was his sort of personality. He was born in a town called Northampton, in a middle-class street on the edge of a middle-sized town in the middle of the English Midlands. So, you know, he's not from a humble background, he's not from the opposite of that. Both his grandfathers were successful businessmen, self-made businessmen. The paternal grandfather, Walter Drawbridge Crick, had built up a shoe business after starting as a railway clerk. But curiously, there's a link with Charles Darwin. Walter Drawbridge Crick he died at the age of 46, but before that he was quite wealthy, and he became an obsessive collector of fossils and mollusks. Those were his two particular fascinations, and he wrote a book about the Liassic foraminifera of Northamptonshire. So he was a bit of a scientist. Naturalist is a better word. Amateur. He corresponded with Charles Darwin. One day in 1882, he went collecting water beetles, and he found a clam attached to the leg of a water beetle, and he thought Darwin would be interested in this, and so although he didn't know Darwin, he sent the clam and the water beetle to Darwin, who was fascinated by this because it helped support Darwin's long-held view that things like clams can spread from pond to pond by hitching a ride on flying animals like water beetles. Darwin published a note about this in Nature, and 13 days later Darwin died. So it was his last publication, was effectively a joint publication with Francis Crick's grandfather, which is quite a nice link between the great biologist of the 19th century and the great biologist of the 20th century. That's Francis Crick with his younger brother Tony in the early 1920s. Tony became a doctor. He emigrated to New Zealand, and he died at the same age as their grandfather, 46, in the 1960s. Their father, Harry Crick, was the second of four sons, and he and his elder brother Walter worked in the shoe business, and it failed in the 1930s. So they were not well off because of the business going bust. He also died about the age of 60, so Francis living to 88 was rather an exception in this family. He went to school first of all Northampton Grammar School, and then he got a scholarship to Mill Hill School, which his father and uncles had been at. It's a school that particularly specialises or used to specialise in recruiting members of non-conformist Protestant faiths. His parents were Congregationalists. They had been Unitarians. As you know, a Unitarian is as close as you can get to being an atheist, I think, without actually being one. But it's important to note that Francis Crick was not a prodigy. He wasn't particularly precocious. Both his great collaborators, Sidney Brenner and James Watson, went to university at the age of 15. Crick didn't. He had really a perfectly ordinary education. Nothing disappointing about it. It was very good, but it wasn't. He didn't particularly light up his teachers with the thought that he might be a genius. Didn't get into Oxford or Cambridge, which he was expected to. He went to University College London instead, which it was known as the godless institution of Gower Street because it was the first university set up in Britain where you didn't have to take religious courses. That suited him for reasons I'll come back to. And at UCL, he didn't get a first-class degree. He got a good second. But he was good enough to get taken on to do a PhD under a physicist called Professor Andrade. And he was told to measure the viscosity of water at 150 degrees centigrade under pressure. And he built an apparatus to do this. He later described, the dullest problem imaginable. And luckily, Hitler put it out of its misery by dropping a bomb directly on it during the war. The war was an important period for Francis. University College London was evacuated from London at the outset of the war, and he was kind of twiddling his thumbs, playing squash every day with his brother, not quite sure what to do because he didn't want to go to Wales with University College London. And then he got a call from a UCL professor called Harry Massey to say would he like to come and be recruited to the Admiralty to work on weapons. And he was particularly going to work on magnetic mines. These are mines that are dropped from aircraft and they sit on the bottom of the ocean, well, not the ocean, but on the bottom of shallow sea, and when a ship goes over them, it distorts the magnetic field of the Earth sufficiently to trigger the mine going off. The British had invented them, predictably, in the First World War, and then not developed them, and were very surprised when the Germans turned out to have developed these weapons dramatically. And in 1939, the first part of the war, when supposedly, you know, nothing much was going on in terms of fighting, actually these weapons came very close to throttling the Port of London. They sank a huge amount of Allied shipping. So it was an important problem. Crick was recruited to a team to try and counter this weapon, to try and understand it and devise countermeasures. But he very quickly got switched to the south coast at Havant to work on offensive mine warfare. So he was designing Allied magnetic mine circuits, the circuits in magnetic mines. And his particular claim to fame relates to a German ship called the Speerbrecher, which means pathbreaker, which is was a particular minesweeper that the Germans built during the war. A German sailor went into a bar in occupied France and boasted about his ship just a little too loudly. He said it had a 500-ton magnet in the bows. This news reached Allied intelligence, who said, well, this must be a magnetic minesweeper, which must set off these mines with its own magnetic field. Massey asked, no, it wasn't Massey by then, it was Collingwood who replaced. Massey had gone to work at the in the Manhattan Project. Massey asked Crick to head a team to try and devise a counterweapon to the Speerbrecher. And he said the answer is going to be to design a specially insensitive magnetic mine that will only go off when a very, very strong magnetic field is directly overhead, i.e. when the Speerbrecher is overhead. And the sort of naval people, you know, the proper sailors, didn't see the point of this. They said, what's the point of putting mines in enemy waters that don't blow up most of the ships that go over them? But he persisted, and they were able, using reconnaissance photographs of Speerbrechers blowing up magnetic mines, to calculate the exact strength of the magnet in the Speerbrecher. They designed a specially insensitive circuit in a magnetic mine, seeded it in the same place off Lorient where they photographed these ships at work, and blew up the ship. And by the end of the war, 100 Speerbrechers had been sunk using these special mines. And they were big ships. So it was an important contribution to the war effort. I don't think it was all Crick's. It's hard to tell because these things are shrouded in sort of secrecy a bit. But he was in charge of a team of about a dozen people working on these special circuits. Towards the end of the war, he actually went abroad for the first time. By then, he'd been switched to work on acoustic weapons, which were weapons that home in on the sounds of ship's engines. For a long time, they'd been trying to capture a German naval acoustic torpedo, which is was a weapon they wanted to get their hands on. The Russians captured one when they sank a submarine called the U-250 and then salvaged it themselves. And after a lot of arguing, Crick and Collingwood were allowed to fly to Moscow and then Leningrad via Persia all the way around through the Mediterranean in early 1945, where they holed themselves up in the Peter and Paul fortress and studied the circuits inside this torpedo. This was right at the end of the war. He made great friends in Leningrad with his interpreter, who was a sailor called Robert Dougal, who was a British, Russian-speaking sailor, who later became, he's the sort of Walter Cronkite of Britain. I mean, he became the first main television newsreader, and he was Crick's flatmate immediately after the war. But when the war came to an end, Crick applied to join Naval Intelligence. He was turned down. C.P. Snow intervened on his behalf and got him re-interviewed, and he got accepted for a job, but he quite quickly decided that he didn't like intelligence and he wanted to leave. He's 30 years old at this point. He has an aborted PhD. He has an aborted marriage. He'd married his college sweetheart during the war, and then she'd run off with a Canadian soldier. And he's got no particular career and no particular expertise. As I say, this is not an early starting precocious prodigy. He decides that he wants to become a scientist. And he's very under the influence at this point of an extraordinary man called Kreisel. Everybody calls him Kreisel, nobody calls him Georg, who was a mathematical philosopher, a student of Ludwig Wittgenstein, who he had met during the war. Kreisel also worked on weapons. And Kreisel sort of taught Crick how to be a bohemian eccentric, it seems, and also taught him how to think rigorously, according to Crick. Crick credits Kreisel with being a very important influence on his life. Kreisel's an extraordinary man. He, notorious philanderer, and later in life, when Crick became famous, Kreisel used to impersonate him abroad in order to try and pick up women. Crick found this out when he got a postcard from somebody in Spain enclosing a photograph of Kreisel with this person, saying, you know, really enjoyed seeing you, etc. And it was all addressed to Francis Crick. So he went to see Kreisel and he said, what's going on? And he said, well, I occasionally use your name. he was arrested on a beach in Morocco once, I think, for propositioning women at random. And he gave the police Crick's name. He's still alive. I saw him a few weeks ago. He was younger than Crick. And he became a quite well-known mathematical philosopher, logician, really, and incompleteness theory and Gödel and all that kind of thing is what he's an expert on. But it was Kreisel who apparently persuaded him that, yes, he could get back into civilian science and do great things. And it was Kreisel who eventually introduced him to Max Perutz, as I will explain. The other person he met towards the end of the war was a Women's Royal Navy officer called Odile Speed, who spilt her shopping on the floor of an office when she was going home one evening, and Crick leapt forward and helped her pick up the vegetables and immediately asked her out. And she said, certainly not. But he came back and asked again a week later. As she put it, this lanky ginger-haired man in a scruffy raincoat. She was a fluent German and French speaking. Her mother was French, her father was English, but she spoke fluent German. She'd spent 2 years in Austria before the war, and she was a she was working in naval intelligence, basically taking down German radio chatter and passing it on to code breakers, which she said was a very, very boring job. And in fact, when he met her, she was translating captured documents about torpedoes, which again was not her cup of tea. She was longing to get out of the forces and back to art school. They were together, of course, as everybody in San Diego knows, for nearly 60 years. And about this time, he also ran into Maurice Wilkins. There's a curious parallel between Wilkins's career and Crick's career. They were both born in 1916. They both died in 2004. They were both born to sort of non-conformist middle-class backgrounds. They both did physics. They both started PhDs. Wilkins was at Cambridge. Wilkins finished his PhD. They both worked on weapons during the war. Wilkins was in the Manhattan Project in Berkeley. So, you know, Wilkins is the glamorous, impressive career at this point. They both had wartime marriages which failed. And Crick befriended Wilkins at the end of the war and got very interested in the work he was working on, which was essentially, under John Randall, to try and find out what a gene was made of. And he was developing the machinery for taking X-ray photographs of DNA. Crick told him to get himself a good protein. Proteins were more interesting than DNA. Wilkins wanted to recruit Crick to King's College London, but John Randall didn't like the look of Crick, said he talked too much. So Crick ended up taking a studentship to go and work at a laboratory called the Strange Ways on the edge of Cambridge, which was not affiliated with the university, where his job was to study the viscosity of cytoplasm by dragging magnetic particles through the insides of cells with magnetic fields. This is probably the second most boring problem imaginable. And after 2 years of this, he was pretty desperate to get out to something more interesting. And that was when Kreisel went to see Max Perutz and said, you should look at this friend of mine. Max Perutz was running this new laboratory at Cambridge inside the Cavendish to try and understand the structure of biological molecules, particularly proteins. The general division of labor was that Bragg at Cambridge was going to do proteins while Randall at King's College was going to do DNA, according to the Medical Research Council. So Crick became Max Perutz's graduate student, even though he was nearly 35 years old and Perutz was only 36. And here he is at the Cavendish Laboratory. He made a bad start at the Cavendish Laboratory. He flooded the laboratory by leaving a tap on or something and flooded Bragg's office. He then irritated Bragg immensely, not only because of his loud laugh and his tendency to ask questions, but also he gave this a seminar called What Mad Pursuit, a phrase from a Keats poem, in which he said, hang on a minute, you guys are not going to solve the structure of proteins using this. It's basically an insoluble problem the way you're going about it, which did not go down terribly well with the great man. And he then effectively accused Bragg of plagiarism. He said that an idea that Bragg had had was one that he'd already had, and he'd told him about it before. Bragg fired off a letter to the Medical Research Council saying, I don't want this chap in my laboratory anymore. He's a troublemaker, he's a loudmouth, he doesn't do any experiments, he just criticizes other people's, and although he's obviously very bright, at the end of his PhD, please, can you make sure he goes somewhere else? there is Bragg. And then September 1951, James Watson walks into his life. And the rest, as one might say, is history. I'm not going to go into the details of the DNA story now. I will a bit this afternoon at the Salk. But suffice to say that there was an extraordinary meeting of minds between these two very different and yet in some ways quite similar people. They were different in one sense, that Watson was a biologist, a geneticist, whereas Crick was a physicist, and they brought complementary knowledge to the problem. They were different in that Crick had an extraordinary ability, which he hadn't yet sort of discovered in himself, to visualize things in three dimensions, to see what a mathematical formula meant in terms of shape and things like that. But they were similar in that they were both obsessed with doing something important, and in particular finding the structure of the gene. By then they were both convinced that genes were molecules and that it therefore ought to be possible to find out the structure of them, and that structure might prove to be interesting. And it's not quite clear whether Crick by now did think that genes were made of DNA. He'd certainly read Avery's papers, or whether Watson persuaded him of that. But according to Jim, he certainly believed that within half an hour of their first meeting. The other thing that they both discovered was that they liked talking to each other. A huge part of this relationship, and indeed of all Francis's scientific relationships was conversation. Sidney Brenner says that conversation was his grand stimulus. That was how he thought, was in a sort of interrogation or debate with a chosen person. Jim Watson was one, Sidney Brenner later on, and of course Christoph Koch in the last 25 years. And I think that's rather unusual. I can't think of any other great scientists for whom this is an important feature, that they had to have a favoured collaborator that they talked with all the time. A very early sketch, possibly the earliest one, it's hard to tell, from the archives, from Crick's papers, of a double helix. As I said, Crick and Watson discovered the double helix, but Crick went on to do an enormous amount more. So did Watson, but Crick's record is even stronger. And just to run through some of the significant work that he did between 1953 and 1966. Well, going back a little earlier, his first breakthrough, actually, within weeks of Watson arriving, had been the helical diffraction theory, the theory of how you of how a helix would show up in an X-ray crystallograph. He did it independently of Bill Cochran, solved the problem one afternoon, and Bragg was slightly mollified. This happened about October 1951, just after Watson arrived, but Watson had nothing to do with it. And it was a very smart piece of mathematics, which of course put him in a very good position to understand the helix is when they came his way in the shape of the double helix. It's worth remembering that it was him and Watson who sat down and worked out what the 20 canonical amino acids in proteins are. They did it in the pub, of course, but they got it right. At the time, biochemists were collecting amino acids like stamps, post-translational modifications of proteins have lots of different amino acids in them, but they worked out what the basic 20 was likely to be. He did make a very the seminar that he gave in 1951 on protein crystallography, where he pointed out that none of the techniques were going to work except isomorphous replacement, was something he later followed up in 1954 with David Blow, and wrote a paper which is one of the great, one of the most cited papers in protein crystallography. So although he didn't do the structure of hemoglobin, he wrote a thesis on it, but he didn't do it, his contribution to that should not be forgotten. Likewise, they came up with a triple helix structure of collagen, he and Alex Rich, in 1954. And of course, in 1954, he wrote this speculative paper saying, I think the way that the code is going to be turned into proteins must involve some kind of little molecular tug that comes along bringing amino acids to the site of the decoding. There must be a molecule that both reads the code at one end and has an amino acid attached to it at the other. We now call it transfer RNA, but it was, when it was discovered in 1956, it almost exactly fitted the description that he'd come up with theoretically. He called it the adapter. One of his more famous ideas is the comma-free code, which is sometimes described as the best wrong idea in science. And this was basically a way in which you could get a code for 20 amino acids using triplets of DNA base pairs in such a way that you would never get an ambiguous or a meaningless codon. I can go into it in detail if you like, but it's as much Leslie Orgel's idea as it is Francis Crick's. It's a beautiful idea, and essentially it's a much neater way of doing the genetic code than the one Mother Nature came up with, which is it would have been much more immune to mutation, but perhaps that's why it wouldn't have worked, because it couldn't have evolved. It's just a very smart piece of logic. 1958, he wrote a very important paper called On Protein Synthesis, in which he summarized everything that he thought was going on between the DNA and the ribosome, or the microsome as it was then called, in terms of transcription and translation and so on, and got nearly all the details right, except, of course, messenger RNA, which was the missing piece of the puzzle that he couldn't get his head around, and that Brenner and Jacob on the one hand and Watson on the other hand came up with independently in 1960. But he drew this general principle, two general principles out of it, the sequence hypothesis, that all you need do is determine the sequence of a molecule and the folding up will happen by itself, so that it's possible to copy a three-dimensional protein by means of a one-dimensional DNA sequence. And the other concept was the central dogma. Now, most people think this is DNA makes RNA makes protein. Actually, Watson quite rightly and rather indignantly claims that he first used that phrase in a letter before the double helix in 1951. What the central dogma says, rather more explicitly, is the sequence information in DNA determines the sequence in protein, but not vice versa. Proteins can't determine their own sequences, and they can't determine the sequences of DNA. This was important because at the time, a lot of biochemists and geneticists had begun to think that because Crick and his friends were getting nowhere with this coding stuff, that they'd misread the whole problem, and that actually genes consisted of reciprocal DNA protein machinery. And he was absolutely insistent that the DNA came first, that it was determining the protein sequence. He called it the central dogma, which got him into a lot of trouble later on, because, and still does, people accuse him of having been a dogmatic person. But it's a bit of a joke, and it's also a sort of, look, I can't prove this, but this is what I think's going on, was what he meant. But his greatest experimental moment was 1961, when he did the triplet code experiments. He did them with Brenner, but most people think these were Brenner's experiments with Crick just helping a bit, or, you know, doing his usual thing of throwing a criticism in. It's not true, actually. He did actually take to the laboratory in 1961 and do this experiment, which proved that the genetic code is written in three-letter words. You probably know the experiment. If not, just very quickly, it involves bacteriophage production of double and triple mutants, getting mutations which there are mutations which suppress each other by adding a letter to the code or subtracting a letter to the code. And if you add a letter and subtract a letter, then you get a normal bacteriophage, so they can cancel each other out. And the brilliant idea was to try and put three mutations into one thing close together, get a triple mutant, and if they were all of the same kind, i.e. they were all insertions or all deletions, then you get a normal bacteriophage, because you've shifted the whole message by three letters, but it's back on track. It's Crick who's really interested in the fact that the code seems to be turning out to be universal. And he first writes about this in 1962, the code in E. coli seems to be the same as in rabbit reticulocytes and in other organisms. And he was genuinely surprised later in his life that this is true. He thought there's absolutely no reason why some alternative early version of the code hasn't survived in a different group of organisms, just like coelacanths and ferns have survived despite the existence of more modern creatures. But it is, when you think about it, a very striking feature of life that it all shares one genetic code. Sure, there are little variations from the canonical code, mostly in ciliates and in mitochondria, but they're small variations rather than big ones. With Sidney Brenner, he was involved in the work that found the first stop codons in 1965, but he didn't actually do any experiments that deciphered any of the codons himself. That was done by Nirenberg and others in the 60s. Just the final touch was this theory called Wobble in 1966, which explains why the third position in a codon doesn't matter very much. A, C, X means the same, whatever X is. This is because he suggested there will not be base pairing at the third position, so as to allow different transfer RNAs to use the same docking site. And that's roughly what there was found, that this base inosine is used in the third position quite often. And then, of course, the culmination of it all is the unveiling of the whole genetic code. As I say, Nirenberg, Ochoa, Karana, Brenner and others had done all the experiments, but it was Crick who put it all together, who went around arbitrating the experiments, conducting the scientific orchestra and unveiling the code. Just back to the relationship with Watson for a minute. After the double helix, they had a couple of occasions on which they fell out. The first came quite soon in October 1953 when Crick wanted to give a talk about the double helix on the BBC. He was by then at the Brooklyn Polytechnic Institute in New York. Watson was at Pasadena at Caltech. Basically, he was very broke at this time. He was living in Brooklyn. Living expenses were rather higher than he expected. He had a wife and a child and a baby on the way, and he wanted $100. And Watson wouldn't let him. And here are Watson's reasons in a letter that he wrote to Crick on October the 9th, 1953. "Concerning the BBC, I still think a talk on the third would be in bad taste. There are still those who think we pirated data. And I'm of the belief that a few enemies are worse than a few admirers. Judging it on a monetary basis, $100 seems unfortunate." Crick replied, "Your name is mud in the Crick household, but I will go along with it." And Crick was furious when Watson then posed for Vogue later that year. This is significant merely because, of course, famously, 15 years later, the boot is on the other foot when Watson writes The Double Helix. And Francis Crick writes some spectacularly vitriolic letters to James Watson in 1966 and 1967 about the book, which was then called Honest Jim. He didn't explode at first. He read a couple of drafts of the book and complained quite a lot about it, but you know, he didn't say don't publish. Then he went to talk to Maurice Wilkins, and they hotted themselves up into a sort of rage at this book. Crick wrote to Harvard University Press, got lawyers to send letters, persuaded Harvard eventually not to publish the book. Of course, it was eventually published by Athenaeum, because Harvard wouldn't publish it in the teeth of Crick's opposition. But some of the phrases in here are really quite spectacular. Your view of history is that found in the lower class of women's magazines. One psychiatrist who saw your collection of pictures said it could only be made by a man who hated women. You know, and so on. If you publish the book now in the teeth of my opposition, history will condemn you for reasons set out in this letter. It's a 6-page letter. Well, he did publish it in the teeth of Crick's opposition. He didn't really change anything. History did not condemn him. Well, it did and it didn't. It's a fantastic and great piece of literature, The Double Helix, because it reveals science to be a human activity done by people, by real people. And that, I think, is what Crick had a problem with. He thought that what they'd achieved was something really rather great, and it was going to be cheapened by being seen as something that they did between tennis matches and parties. He wasn't really, I don't think, offended by Jim Watson's first sentence, which, as you know in the book, is, "I've never seen Francis Crick in a modest mood." Because the remarkable thing is that despite these letters, very soon after the book came out, they patched up their friendship. Watson went over and held out the olive branch and introduced his new wife to Francis. And Crick admitted that he'd overreacted and that actually it is rather a good bit of literature. And in fact, there's quite a lot of science in the book, which is what he'd wanted. And I think he realized, of course, that he was the hero of this book as well. But it's an interesting episode because it partly reflects how ambivalent he was about fame. He really didn't enjoy being famous. When the Nobel Prize came, he had this card made to put people off. He wouldn't let his photograph appear in newspapers if at all possible. He tried to keep a very tight control. He borrowed this idea from the literary critic Edmund Wright, but nonetheless it's got his own phrases in it. I like cure your disease. And sometimes if he was asked to attend a conference or give a seminar, he would write back saying, I know it's a year away, but I have to be at a funeral on that date. And that, of course, is the background to his concerns about the Double Helix book. Crick was an atheist. I think most of you probably know that, from the age of 12. And at some point in the 60s, when he felt that his work had dealt a pretty mortal blow to a form of vitalism, the idea that there's something special and irreducibly mysterious at the heart of life, he thought that religion was on the way out. And this is very well illustrated by a row that happened over a chapel in Cambridge in 1961. There's a chapel at Churchill College, Cambridge, but it's the chapel at Churchill, not the Churchill Chapel. And that's because of Crick. Churchill College was founded in about 1960, and Crick was asked to be a fellow. He accepted, but on condition that they didn't build a chapel. Because he said, look, the churches of Cambridge are half empty, and it's ridiculous to believe that anyone is going to go on believing Christianity for very much longer, or words to that effect. And they said, well, don't worry, we're not going to build a chapel unless someone gives a special donation to build a chapel. It's not going to come out of college funds. So he said, okay. Within a year, somebody had given a special donation, and they started building a chapel. He resigned. He wrote a letter to Winston Churchill, who was still alive, saying, I'm sorry I've resigned from the chapel that bears your illustrious name, and here's the reason. Churchill replied, I don't understand your reason for resigning. There's nothing wrong with a chapel. Nobody need go in one unless they wish. So Crick replied, saying, I enclose a cheque for 10 guineas towards the Churchill College Heterae Fund. And as those of you who are Greek scholars like Stuart know, heterae means courtesans. Essentially, he was suggesting building the Churchill College brothel. He said, nobody need go in it unless they wish, and it will be open to people of all denominations. Churchill didn't reply to that letter. But it does illustrate this point that he thought religion was on the way out, which is historically an interesting little thing to think about. He offered £100 for an essay competition, What Can Be Done with the College Chapels in Cambridge. The winning entry was that they'd be turned into swimming pools, apparently. John Kendrew sent this cutting to Jim Watson with, Why don't you submit an essay, on the bottom. And the college chaplains in Cambridge retaliated with an offer of £100 for What Can Be Done with Dr. Crick. And again, John Kendrew suggested that Jim Watson write an entry. So this is the note that Kendrew sent to Watson. Cricks were famous for their parties in the 1960s in Cambridge, open house. This was the famous occasion when not only were you encouraged to come as an artist, model, or dancing girl, but when you came in, you were handed a sketch pad and pencil and told that in one of the upstairs rooms there was a nude model and you could go and sketch her if you wanted. This caused quite a sensation in Cambridge at the time, I can tell you. The human side of Francis Crick's life. And that, of course, is a drawing by O'Deal. And so to his final assault on the mysteries of the world, consciousness. He had wanted to study consciousness when he left the Navy, but decided life would be slightly easier to solve first. And what he was after, of course, was finding somewhere in the brain the manifestation of a conscious percept, so that when you see this Necker cube from one view rather than the other, then there's something different happening in your brain depending on which way you see it. you all know more about that story probably than I do here in at UCSD. So, ladies and gentlemen, Francis Crick, thank you very much.
Has that
been suggested? I mean, in psychology texts particularly, as an example.
I still talk about it so much, but yes, mm-hmm. I've seen it referred to.
Well,
in the context of incubation.
Well, Crick's view was that Crick, by the way, was a very good tennis player as a child, but he gave it up completely before he met Watson, and he never played with Watson, which is a shame, because Watson's mad about tennis, as you know. Crick, the one important sort of tennis match, I'm sorry, I know you're not asking about tennis particularly, but the one important tennis game that does feature in Crick's memories was that while Watson was off playing tennis, Crick rebuilt the model with the chains going in opposite directions after having this insight from seeing Rosalind Franklin's report that it must be an object with twofold rotational symmetry, and therefore that implied that one chain must go up and one chain must go down. You know the point that this object has one-fold rotational symmetry, it's got to go all the way around before it looks the same again. That object has two-fold rotational symmetry. And so he had suddenly spotted that the chains went in opposite directions. This solved a huge geometric problem because it meant that they had 36 degrees for each base pair instead of 18. That was all done apparently while Jim was playing tennis one afternoon. So it's slightly the opposite point that you're making, that get Jim out of the way while we rebuild the model. But if you read the way they spent their days, they wandered in about 10 to the Cavendish and talked till coffee, which was at 11. And then they talked during coffee. Then they did a bit of work. And then they went off to the Eagle for lunch and talked. And then in the afternoon, they maybe did some work, but then there was tea at about 3:30, you know. So if the incubation was happening, the importance of conversation is crucial. And of course, what was not happening at King's College was any kind of meaningful engagement between Rosalind Franklin and Maurice Wilkins, who couldn't get on.
Could you say something about how he was lured here to La Jolla?
Yes. He joined the... He became a what's the word, external fellow of the Salk on its foundation in 1961. He was invited by Jonas Salk then, one of 5 or 6 people who were the sort of external fellows. And he did 2 6-year terms as that and used to come out every year and loved it out here. And then in the 70s, he was kind of at a loose end. He couldn't settle down. He tried embryology, he tried chromosome structure, various things which he was interested in, but they didn't really click with him. And he was a bit rootless, and he wasn't sure what he wanted to do. And then suddenly he realized he was going to be made to retire by the Medical Research Council, which had a mandatory retirement age of 65. I mean, not till 1981, but he saw it looming, and he was horrified by the idea of retiring. So he took a sabbatical at the Salk for a year in 1976, and he turned it into a permanent job. I mean, he was given a permanent job offer, and he took it. There's another version of the story, which is that he was just a little worried that there was a big bust of the drug scene in Cambridge going on by the police. And he knew a couple of these people. And he was keen to get out of there. I don't really believe that story, but it may have played a very, very small part in his calculation.
That's out of the pan and into the
fire.
Yeah, but I think there wasn't an extradition treaty.
Thank you.
You mentioned his dependence on conversation for developing his ideas, and it occurred to me that it's a little odd in the light of that that he didn't actually have a greater number of junior acolytes and students. And I wonder if you, I don't have any insight into that. I wonder if you have any, if you've wondered about that. Ideas about it.
Well, he and Sidney Brenner did hire sort of postdocs from time to time. And I've talked to some of them, and the method of recruitment was certainly eccentric. Graham Mitchison was asked if he was good with his hands. He said, "Well, I play the piano," and he was hired. Yeah, no, we know in Graham that it's quite. Yeah, it's a good point that, I mean, Mark Brecher was his PhD student when he did work on the code. I think he was the first, or Jim Offengand was his first PhD student. There were a few in the LMB. But the problem was he wasn't, I mean, it was Sidney who did all the experiments, who ran the lab, as it were. And so it wasn't obvious what a Crick student would do. But I think you've made a good point, actually, Don. I hadn't sort of thought of it like that. But he wanted equal partners for these conversations. You know, he wanted someone like Sidney or Jim or Christoph. You know, who are they're not shrinking violets. You know, they punch back, and that's part of the point.
He made in the astonishing hypothesis in the introduction. He actually made a statement about who he'd like to talk to, if I recall correctly.
Did he?
And it was a bit like that card. Kind of making, you know, deterring people from writing him and trying to contact him.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a flavor of what you just said, actually.
One of the key things was that you could say stupid things to each other and no one would mind, but you could also say they were stupid and no one would mind. Do you see what I mean? That was something that he was very, very insistent on. And Stuart, you were reminding, or no, Roger was reminding me beforehand that he said this to me, I remember, I can tolerate people saying stupid things for 20 minutes, but no more.
Right.
You know, so he would give anyone a chance, but if they hadn't said anything clever in 20 minutes, he wasn't interested in them.
There are some examples of that at seminars.
Yes.
20 minutes into the seminar, there's an explosion.
Well, yes, and from then on,
right. Thank God the picture hasn't come to life.
Well, I think there's no more questions. I think I'll speak to Natalia for lunch. Matt is staying with me tonight. Some of you may have been to my house. If Matt had his house, my house is...
Oh, shut up about my house.
Yeah, my house is gone. I'm probably keeping the chickens in it. I want to talk to you all again.
So I really am going to buy that.
You know, revolutionary.
Do you think it'll probably go for quite a long time?